From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Roy Kinnard joins us this week. He is the author of several books on classic films, including the films of Fay Wray. And his latest book, and it's a beauty, is The Flash Gordon Serials, 1936 to 1940, A Heavily Illustrated Guide. Roy Kinnard, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. It's nice to be here.
I love this book. It's beautiful, right from the cover to the back cover. It's great. And before we get started talking about your book, I know there's a couple of co-authors on the book. Do you want to mention them?
Well, my co-authors are Tony Srinkovich. He's a commercial illustrator, professional illustrator, who also lives in Chicago. And my second co-author is R.J. Vitone, Rick Vitone, who was the owner of the Variety Bookstore in Chicago. Unfortunately, Rick passed away in late 2009.
Well, and how did they contribute, both of them, to the book? Did you do all the writing and they did the graphics or what?
Well, I did the writing. Tony and Rick supplied a lot of rare photos from their personal collections, which are very difficult to get.
And they're beautiful. Gosh, one of these pictures of Gene Rogers, I'm just going to have to put up on my wall. And
yes, okay. I don't blame you.
She was hot. But,
yes, she was.
Well, we'll get to her in just a second. Your book, it's not just about the Flash Gordon serials, but it's really about the art of the serial. Is the serial sort of a lost art form?
Yes, it is. Movie serials began in 1912, 1913. They made the last one in 1956. There was just no need for them after that point because of television. And there were about 250 silent serials and about the same number of sound serials.
How many of those silent ones still exist, you know?
Not many at all. I would say probably fewer than a couple of dozen.
I guess The Perils of Pauline is probably the most well-known.
Yeah, that's probably the most famous silent serial. Even that, they only have a 9-chapter abridged version of it. So the complete version of it does not exist.
How many chapters was it originally?
20.
And although this sort of it's kind of the quintessential cliffhanger serial, but really there weren't any cliffhangers in that one.
No, in that particular one, each chapter was a story complete in itself, more or less. You could almost watch it as a watch each episode as a two-reeler short dramatic film complete in itself. The cliffhanger aspect of serials came along a little later and continued that way up until the last of them in the 1950s.
Now, certain studios did not make serials. I mean, was there ever an MGM serial?
No, never. MGM was above that.
They looked down upon the serials?
Yeah, they just didn't do that type of thing. 20th Century Fox didn't make them, nor Paramount.
But now, Flash Gordon, that's a pretty high-quality serial.
Yes, it was. Someone looking at these things today, who's used to Star Wars and all these digital special effects, they may think these things are incredibly crude and rough. But by the standards of that time and the standards of serials in particular, these were really something special. The average sound serial in the 1930s cost about $100,000. The first Flash Gordon was budgeted around $350,000.
And so it's really like a 4.5-hour long movie.
Yes, although it was never intended to be seen with the episodes back to back. I mean, it was one episode a week in the theaters. And, of course, now with home video, you've got the option of watching the entire serial in one sitting if you choose to do that.
They probably don't hold up as well as they did if you saw them one per week. I don't know. Maybe that's a judgment on
that. Well, one. I would say this is my personal point of view. The first one I can watch in one sitting. It's good enough to bear up under that, but as I said, you know, it was never intended to be seen that way. It's 20 minutes a week, and that's what was intended.
Now, there is edited, you know, feature-length version of them. Was that done subsequently, much later, or was it done at the time, or what?
Well, the first Flash Gordon serial was released in 1936, and the theatrical feature version was made at the same time.
Oh.
The same with the second serial, Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars. They also made a feature version at the same time. Later on, in the mid-1960s, they made new feature versions for television that were slightly longer in running time than the original feature versions.
Well, let's get into the Flash Gordon serials for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up watching them because they used to show them on TV a lot. I guess they were perfect for, you know, in the early days of television, there wasn't
sure.
a lot to put on. So
sure.
We got to see a lot of old shorts, The Little Rascals and
sure, Sarah. Flash Gordon, Superman, and the Three Stooges. That was my childhood.
Mine too. But, you know, and when I was a kid, I ate up the Flash Gordon serials, and I never thought of them as ridiculous or campy in any way, which
mm-hmm.
I guess now they do seem sort of campy. I mean, when you think about these grown men running around in these particular costumes. what was the atmosphere on the set like?
According to everyone I've talked to, Buster Crabbe, Gene Rogers, and so on, they had a pretty hard time keeping a straight face, even when these were made.
They're also, I guess, today they could be criticized as being incredibly sexist, not just because the two female characters, the good girl and the bad girl, both of whom are incredibly hot, run around with hardly any clothes on, but because, you know, like in the rocket ship, when they're first going to the planet Mongo, there's not enough oxygen for Gene Rogers' character, but there's plenty of oxygen. plenty of oxygen for the men.
Well, you know how women are. They just can't hold up under stress.
But who wrote these stories? Were they actually written by Alex Raymond, who had created the character?
Yes. The genesis of the strip is pretty interesting. Actually, it was created in competition to compete with the Buck Rogers comic strip.
So Buck came first, then?
Yes, Buck came first. There had been a novel published in a science fiction pulp magazine called Amazing Stories. This was in 1928, and the title was Armageddon 2419 AD. Now, this was a science fiction good guys versus bad guys story that any fan of Star Wars would recognize. And it was a big hit, and the John F. Dill newspaper syndicate bought the rights and adapted it as a comic strip. Now, the comic strip was very successful. The thing is, it was gadget-heavy, as you would expect a science fiction story to be. I mean, lots of ray guns, lots of spaceships, but not much characterization. Now, the following decade, in 1934, King Features, a rival newspaper syndicate, wanted to compete with the Buck Rogers strip, so they assigned one of their artists, Alex Raymond, to create a character. And what he came up with was Flash Gordon. Now, whereas the Buck Rogers strip was short on characterization, Flash Gordon was very heavy on it, and there was a pronounced romantic aspect to the strip that was totally lacking in Buck Rogers.
Also, it seems to me that the Flash Gordon story, even though it takes place in space and there are floating cities and so forth,
mm-hmm.
it's really much more of a sword and sorcery kind of...
Yes, it is. It is. It's. I would classify it... more sword and sorcery and fantasy than science fiction, really. It really doesn't... a lot of people think it takes place in the future, but it really doesn't.
Buck Rogers takes place in the future.
Yeah, Buck Rogers is in the 25th century, but Flash Gordon takes place right now. He's just on another planet, that's all.
Right now, in 1936.
Yes.
and space travel... I guess, was perfected by his friend, Dr. Zarkov.
Apparently, yes.
And wearing shorts, short shorts, probably not a good idea for Dr. Zarkov. Let's just be frank about that.
No.
He's got terrible legs, that guy.
Yeah.
Who's the actor who played Dr. Zarkov?
That was Frank Shannon, character actor. He was in several films in the 1930s. He was one of his... appearances in a major film would have been the John Ford film, Shark Island, Prisoner of Shark Island.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Sure.
He was in that.
About Dr. Mudd.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
We're talking with Roy Kinnaird, and he's a film historian, and his new book is called The Flash Gordon Serials, 1936 to 1940. And now, Larry Buster Crabb had been an Olympic swimmer, like Johnny Weissmuller.
Yes. And I'll tell you, Crabb, he was very self-effacing. Kind of laughed off his movie work, but he was very proud of his athletic accomplishments.
So you got to meet him in person, or you spoke with him on the phone?
Yes, I met him two or three times in person, and we did one long phone interview that was about 2 hours long in the early 1980s.
He's since passed away, of course.
Yes, he passed away in 1983.
And so what Olympics was he in? The same Olympics as Weissmuller?
I believe he was in both the 28 and 32 Olympics.
And that led to a movie career.
Yes. He was cast as Tarzan in a serial, Tarzan the Fearless.
Right.
And was signed up by Paramount Pictures after that.
And did he make many pictures other than the Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers serials?
Well, he was very popular in B Westerns. He made a lot of westerns for Paramount and later on for small companies like PRC.
Could he ride?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You had to.
And they actually worked a lot of swimming scenes into Flash Gordon serials. There's a lot of water in the...
Well, in chapters 3 and 4 of the first serial, they go to the underwater kingdom of the Sharkmen, so there's plenty of opportunity for him to demonstrate his swimming prowess there.
And did they build a tank, or how did they shoot that?
That was in a studio tank, all those swimming scenes, and I did talk to him about that, and he said it was very unpleasant because they did not heat the water.
Oh, God.
So they were in this cold water all day, and the stagehands had a tendency to toss their cigarette butts in there, and wasn't very pleasant.
And there's also a scene, what, episode 6 or something, when water comes crashing down on he and... Dale.
Yeah, that was kind of a forced perspective shot. The water was kind of closer to the camera than the people, and it looked like there was a lot more of it than there actually was.
I think the main purpose of it was to get Dale wet, if I'm not
wrong. Yeah, right. They did do that. Yes.
I love it when she's backed up against the wall and the drooling Hawkman. Picture this, listeners. There's this guy who plays the Hawkman, and he's a great big fat guy, and he's got bigger breasts than Gene Rogers had.
that was John Lipson. He was a comedian, and you see him pop up in films throughout the 30s, and he's even in a couple of Three Stooges shorts.
He's great as he corners her against the wall and laughs because he's got a big bear that's painted like a raccoon.
I talked to Gene Rogers about these serials, and she was very amused by them at the time.
Was she? Yeah.
And she just loved to talk about this stuff.
Well, she was a beautiful woman. Tell us a little bit about her.
Gene was she was born in Belmont, Massachusetts. She was 19 in the first Flash Gordon, and she had been a beauty contest winner, won a trip to. Hollywood for a screen test, and Universal signed her up for the magnanimous sum of $250 a week.
That was big money.
Well, it wasn't bad for back then, but she was pretty angry about it when she began to circulate around the studio and found out what everyone else was making.
And did she make any other pictures?
Well, she after the second Flash Gordon serial, she was signed by 20th Century Fox, and she was in Glenn Ford's first feature, which was called Heaven with a Barbed Wire Fence. And she appeared in about 50 features throughout the 30s, 40s, and early 50s.
And you met her also. I know you dedicated your book to her.
Yes, I was invited to her house several times, and we had... several long interviews and conversations about these films.
And what about the lovely arched-eyebrowed Priscilla Lawson?
Priscilla had kind of a tragic life. According to what I've been able to find out, she was in the service during World War II and lost a leg in an accident. And when she returned home, she supposedly ran a stationery store somewhere in Los Angeles, and she died very young in 1958, I believe. She was only about 46.
Oh, it's because she was so evil. Oh, no, she wasn't actually evil, but the character she played, although she was heartsick for Flash, she was the daughter of the evil Ming the Merciless.
Yes, and I think she did a very good job in the film.
I think so, too.
And I think she should have had a much more successful career, but it just didn't work out for her.
I guess the actor with the most experience both before and after the Flash Gordon serials is probably Charles Middleton.
Yes. Charles Middleton, he was already 60 years old in the first serial. He had been around for quite a while. He had started out in vaudeville. He had a song and dance act with his wife, if you can imagine him singing and dancing. And he was also in the circus for a while, an acrobat. And a lot of theater work, a lot of early movie work in the silence.
I remember him in Laurel and Hardy's.
Yeah. He did a lot of Laurel and Hardy. He even turns up as a truant officer in some of the Little Rascals shorts.
He was born to play Ming the Merciless, though.
Yes, yes. And Buster Crabbe, as he said to me, he said, we wouldn't have had much without Charlie. He was the glue that held those things together.
And again, it must have been hard to keep a straight face, you know, for these, you know, really, I mean, you know, he's a pretty respectable actor. I mean, he plays that part to the hilt.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I'll tell you, I... not to get off on a tangent here, but one
we
thing
love
I really
tangents on From the Picture.
Okay, one thing I really care about is film preservation, and I would love to see a restoration in 35 millimeter of all three of these films.
Mm-hmm. That hasn't been done.
Well, no, not to the degree that it should be, because. The second one in particular, when it was released, it was printed on color stock, and it was tinted green.
Really?
Yeah, and it's never been seen like that since the original release in 1938. And you know, I'd really like to see that restored to that state.
Well, I mean, they are fine films, and if you're going to preserve anything, I mean, they, you know, they're time capsules of a period in American history when these serials were the top entertainment available.
Absolutely. And another thing I'd like to touch on, you know, all this digital technology we have now is really wonderful. I mean, they can do just anything that can be conceived, and they can do it convincingly.
Yeah, but these filmmakers had to be creative.
Yes, and what bothers me about modern fantasy films is they're so perfect. There's nothing special about the special effects anymore.
Well, that's true. I mean, the giant lizards that are, you know, I mean, they're, you know, they're really apparently iguanas with like silly putty.
Sure, sure.
But there's, I don't know, there's, when I was a kid, they scared me. I thought they were big giant lizards.
Sure. And, you know, I'm sure people, even at the time, you know, they could see, I mean, that was pretty transparent fakery, but, I mean, they were willing to meet halfway.
Well, Roy Kinnard, I know you've also written about Willis O'Brien, who was the creator of stop-action animation characters, including the great King Kong, probably the greatest stop-action animation ever made, and Mighty Joe Young and The Lost World and so forth. But even in King Kong, the thing that's so great about that kind of work is that in Kong, you can see Willis O'Brien's thumbprint in Kong, you know, in some scenes.
Sure.
But yet you still care about Kong. I mean, he still captures your heart.
Well, see, films like that, I think part of it is, part of the appeal is they look like they were made by human beings. They look like people touched them and there was a human element involved. If you saw the Peter Jackson remake of King Kong, it looks like what it is. It was processed out of a digital keyboard. And it looks great in certain scenes, but yeah, I really felt it was extraneous. It was unnecessary.
Why remake a movie as great as King Kong?
Sure, and it had already been remade in the 1970s.
Oh, that was not good.
No.
Let's pretend that didn't happen. although the Kong looked pretty good in that. I mean, Kong looks great, but I don't think he looks as good as he looks when Willis O'Brien made him.
No, I agree. Okay,
if you don't mind, let's talk about King Kong a little bit, since you've mm-hmm. written about Willis O'Brien. Was there more than one Kong? Did he have a series of models for Kong, or how did that work?
Well, the way they did that, the stop-motion figure was 18 inches tall. That's what you see in most of the scenes. They did have a full-sized head. They had a full-sized arm and a full-sized foot. And these were used for interaction with the actors. And, you know, there have been reports from time to time of actors in ape suits and that kind of nonsense, you know, but it just isn't true. You know, it's all either animation or full-scale props.
It really is a remarkable achievement, and I think it still holds up. And it's just been released on Blu-ray, so I guess there's still a lot of interest in King Kong.
Sure, sure there is.
Have you had a chance to see the Blu-ray?
No, a friend of mine just called me, as a matter of fact, just before you called, and told me that he had a copy of it, so I'll probably be watching it this weekend.
Now, have you watched it enough, or are you still interested in watching it again?
Well, you know, there are certain, I think there are certain movies, and this all depends on individual taste, but there are certain films that I think they're like paintings. You know, you can look at them over and over again, especially, you know, in the home video era, you know, you have the option of looking at just scenes, you know, if you want to.
Right. Yeah, no, I was watching Casablanca recently and reciting it along with the movie, and my wife said, well, you know, you have this movie by heart. Why you bother to watch? And I said, well, you know, there's a lot of great songs I know by heart, but I still want to hear them again.
Well, you know, when I was a teenager, the big film was, I'm dating myself here, but this would be in the late 60s, 2001 Space Odyssey.
Sure.
I must have seen it 50 times.
Well, can you explain it to us on another show?
We're chatting with Roy Kennard, and his new book is called The Flash Gordon Serials, 1936 to 1940, a heavily illustrated guide. It's a beautiful book, and it's also available on the Kindle, by the way.
Tell us just a little bit about your book about Fay Wray. Now, I think everybody knows that Fay Wray was in King Kong.
Yes.
She made other films as well.
Fay Wray was, she had to be one of the nicest persons I've ever met in connection with this kind of work. I originally met her, I did an article on her for a magazine called Films and Review, and it was supposed to be with her participation, but she could not do it at the time. I wrote to her, she sent me a very nice note that she couldn't participate, so I did it without her. And one evening I was sitting at home, and I, you know, the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was her. She had seen the article, thought it was wonderful, and just called me to thank me over and over again for doing such a great job on it. And
that must have been a thrill.
Yes, yes. Well, King Kong has always been one of my top favorite films, and eventually. She gave me her phone number. We kept in touch on the phone, and I happened to mention one time that I was going to be in Los Angeles, and she says, well, I have to take you to dinner. And, you know, it isn't very many movie fans who get taken to dinner in Beverly Hills by their by the star of their favorite film.
That's amazing. So what are some other great films of hers?
Well, she was in, her first big role was in an Erich von Stroheim-directed film called The Wedding March, one of the biggest silent films, one of the last silent films. It was made in 1928. And she was in a series of Paramount pictures with people like William Powell, Gary Cooper, some of the top stars. And by the early 1930s, she was more or less gone from Paramount. She was a freelance actress, and she did couple of horror films, like classic horror films, Mystery of the Wax Museum, Dr. X, those were both in Technicolor. And continued on throughout the 1930s. After a certain point, she was confined mostly to B pictures. By 1942, she had remarried, and she was out of the business.
So she made her last picture in the 40s then?
As a leading lady. She did. Her husband, second husband, died of a brain embolism, and she had to go back to work in the 1950s in character roles.
Well, Roy Kennard, it's just been a pleasure to pick your brain and talk movies with you, and I hope you'll come back and join us again.
I will, Gary.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary.
That ends this exciting chapter of From the Bookshelf. Be sure to join us next week to find out what happens to me and my books. I want to thank Roy Kennard, the author of Flash Gordon Serials, 1936 to 1940, A Heavily Illustrated Guide, for being my guest this week. And I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the daring and resourceful Brianne Beal. Thanks, Brianne. Please be sure to check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.